So today is April 16th, actually my brother's birthday, born 54 years ago today, anyway, and 2014, and I'm Rick Hansen. And I wanted to talk with you tonight about, as I said earlier, what in psychology languages are called narcissistic needs and narcissistic supplies and narcissistic cravings. And the larger context here is my own exploration, especially in the last few months in terms of these talks, in grounding the second and third of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths in the context of evolutionary neuropsychology. In other words, the first truth being that there is suffering, second truth that what causes suffering, a primary cause of suffering, are drive states, craving, broadly defined, based on underlying felt sense of deficit or disturbance, or habitual patterns, even when there really isn't much underlying sense of deficit or disturbance or any at all. And then there's the possibility in the third noble truth of actually bringing those drive states to an end, of turning off the engine of craving, still being engaged with life, still wishing well, still aspiring, still howling at the moon on a good night with friends, but not caught in that automaticity, that kind of robotic drivenness, those not compelled by those scripts and those programs that are the embodiment of craving, broadly defined. So the question, of course, is how to do that, especially when we have a brain that's been carefully honed by evolution over 600 million years for maximum survival effectiveness in Stone Age conditions. And with this brain, we naturally suffer and crave to survive. So how do you actually turn that engine off? And last week, we talked about attachment theory in psychology and how our early childhood experiences and even experiences later in childhood and later in life in adulthood tend to sort us into one of three patterns, secure attachment, insecure anxious, or insecure avoidant. And how we manage those attachment patterns is a major factor in our craving, because we crave if we feel insecurely attached. A particular issue around attachment has to do with what are generally called narcissistic supplies, and I'll explain all this. So I want to do this talk in three parts, one being what happens in childhood, especially early childhood, around feeling special and important and mattering and seen and recognized and wanted or not, and then what the impact of that is. Second part of what I want to talk about here is what we do about all that now as adults and how that shows up in everyday life, for better or worse. And then third part in particular, I'll offer four suggestions about what we can do about it and try to preserve time to talk about this more. This is a big topic. I'm kind of amazed that I'm going to go after it in about 30 minutes, but what the heck, you know? Okay, so that's the deal, all right, here we go. All right, so start one. What helps with this material is to make it real for yourself as much as possible. It's intellectually interesting. There is a place for thinking about it from a third-person perspective, as it happens for other people, including with guilty conscience alert, with our own children, right? But where it gets really powerful is when you feel your way into it from the inside out. Okay? So in that sense, here you are the day you were born. And as you come out of the box, as it were, one way or another, there's only one thought in your mind. What the hell is this? There you are, you're completely helpless. They've inflicted consciousness on unsuspecting flesh. You have almost no control over your bodily functions other than a bare sucking reflex. You can't even make your eyes focus. You know, you're bombarded with stimuli after that warm, cozy, nice place where you used to be kept. And you just want to go back, speaking personally. So, but there you are, you're out, you're exposed. And you're exposed, and they do all kinds of strange things to you, and all these weird people are around you, and you have no idea what's going on. And you hurt. You know, children, young children especially, feel things much more keenly than adults do, because the anatomical maturation of the regions in the brain that dampen affective experience, that lower the intensity of both pleasure and pain, it takes years for those to really come online. So yeah, the pleasures of an infant or a toddler or a preschooler or maybe greater, usually often, than those of an adult, but so are the pains. So there you are, you come out, your stomach gurgles, it fills with gas, it hurts, you're hungry and they don't know it, you make sounds and sometimes they help you and other times they like bump you roughly because they don't like the sounds you're making, and all kinds of strange bodily fluids just flow out of you from all orifices and you have no control over it, and then they got to deal with you, right? That's, hello, welcome to infancy, all right? So in that context then, you're trying to sort stuff out. You don't speak English yet. You have no idea. Your sleep cycle isn't normalized. You know, kind of like, where am I? And you're trying to figure out fairly quickly, what's this thing here? What's my relationship to it, you know? And also, what are those blurry, blobby, warm thingies over there that come and they go? And sometimes when they come, it feels better. And sometimes when they come, it feels worse, right? And sometimes when they go, it feels worse. And sometimes when they go, it feels better. Like, what's going on here? So you try to sort that out. And fairly quickly, you try to sort out what helps and what hurts. And within a few months, you're starting to form some sense of who am I to these people and who are they to me? Right? And then by around 9 months, something really remarkable happens, which is the advent of what Edward Tronick called intersubjectivity. The basic idea that there's a growing recognition in this infant, 9 months is still very young, okay, can barely sit up straight, if that. You know, there's a growing sense that you have states of mind like I do too. So we can share an attentional focus. I can show you something, and then I can watch your eyes, and if your eyes go to this thing that I think is really neat, right, then I'll get that you and I are tuned into each other mentally. We're like-minded. We're of the same mind. And with the beginning of intersubjectivity, what was previously a fairly primitive, concrete matter of are you going to help me or not, becomes increasingly psychologized as how are you representing me? Who am I to you? What are you thinking about me? What are you feeling about me? What are your intentions toward me? We start becoming preoccupied with, you know, how do I live in your mind? Other animals actually do that as well. Through the motor neurons, the mirror neurons or mirror-like networks really in the brain, we can form, even other animals, fairly primitive animals, certainly mammals, can form some sense over here of the intentions of a predator or prey or member of their own species over there by having the same neurons, you know, or subset, a small percentage of the same neurons activate over here that activate when I do that thing, but now activate when I see you, predator, prey, or member of my own species doing that thing. So I'm forming a rudimentary sense of your own intentions even without being a 9-month-old infant. Also, for example, magpies, very smart birds, they belong to the corvid group, and what magpies will do is they will trick other magpies, because magpies steal food from each other. But if you're going to trick a magpie, what they'll do, this magpie here, I'm a magpie, whoosh, whoosh, okay, so I see you see I have some food, and I know you, you're going to steal my food. So what I'm going to do, and you're going to keep searching for my food, right? So what I'm going to do is make sure you're watching. Huh? I'm going to put my little food over here, right, under the tree, kind of notice that you're seeing it. Then I'm going to go away, except I've got most of my food somewhere else. And I'm watching you go get my food over there. I fooled you. Now, you can't do that if you're a magpie, if you're not able to represent something of the state of mind of the other bird, right? So there is some rudimentary capacity to represent states of mind. Also, as we evolve in small hunter-gatherer bands, for any kind of altruism to develop, we had to beat the freeloader problem. Otherwise, altruism, which is extremely rare in the animal kingdom, would get extinguished because altruists would be stupid. They'd give their bananas away today and just assume they'd get a banana tomorrow, but they're not going to get any banana tomorrow, so they starve to death. Right? What interrupts freeloading and what allows the emergence of altruism, broadly defined? What interrupts freeloading is having your reputation known in a small band. So that if I give you a banana today because I'm altruistic, and you don't give me a banana tomorrow, you know there'll be a cost. And the next time you need a banana, no one's going to give you a banana because they won't expect you to pay them back. So as our ancestors evolved, again in small bands, roughly over about, reaching back around 10 million years, and especially the last 3 million or so years, as childhood got longer and longer, and people in the bands needed to become increasingly altruistic to pass on their genes. As that happened, it was critically important that people became able to represent the states of minds of others and know how they stood with others and get an inkling of what other people thought of them. And it was literally a matter of life and death that other people thought well of you. So there's been a long process that's led to this very natural need to care about what other people think about us. So then now we're back to our 9-month-old infant and then older, and as this child grows up, as we grow up, the child is starting to really track nuances around who am I to you? Do you recognize me? Do you recognize me as a being altogether, or am I just a thing in your space? Do you recognize me as someone who can suffer? Do you recognize the ways that I'm actually different from you? Rather than shoving your own personality or value system or priorities on me, can you recognize actually that I'm not an extension of you? I'm not innately a means to your ends. Can you recognize my special qualities? You know, the cute little way I have when I eat that chocolate chip cookie, as a 2-year-old, the abilities I'm developing. Can you recognize my good intentions so that even if I knock over the glass of milk, I was doing it because I was just trying to get the salt and I'm not very skillful yet. Can you see me? Right? Beyond recognizing, do you value what you see? Do you think it's kind of cool? Do you like my pictures? Is my song good? Do you think I'm kind of cute? Do you value what you recognize? Because you see, valuing is distinct from recognizing. And then last, not just recognizing, not just valuing, do you want me? Do I matter to you? Am I that bunny in the runaway bunny that you will keep turning into a bird or a cloud or a dragon or I have no idea what? To keep coming after me to come get me. Do you want me? As Winnicott, the great British psychiatrist, said about children playing these games that are all about testing whether you want me. Will you seek me? Peekaboo, do you see me? Or hide and go seek, will you come get me? The way Winnicott put it was that it's a joy to be hidden, a disaster not to be found. Right? We want to be found, okay? And all these little interactions in which we feel recognized or not, valued or not, wanted or not. Wanted means included with our parents, with our peers. Will you include me in your game? You're my big brother. You got your buddy over. You're doing that really neat video thing. Are you going to let me play too? Right? Are you going to include me or not? When I'm in junior high, and there's this clique, there are the cool kids, the A table, the A team. Are you going to let me sit at the head table? Are you going to bring me into your group? Or are you going to cast me out? Are you going to do those things to me that social animals routinely do to organize an in-group by targeting a pariah, an outcast, a scapegoat, and organizing their in-group by defined as what they're against, that scapegoat? Thus discrimination, prejudice, ethnic cleansing, and other horrors. So, all this is happening, and then it happens in adulthood as well. a lot of the learning of this gets internalized, right, along the way, and it's a profoundly natural process that most people, including me, have historically been ashamed of. In other words, it's a double whammy. We experience inadequacy, feeling unwanted, feeling dismissed, devalued, exiled, voted off the island. You know, we feel shame, broadly defined. Not just that there's something wrong here, you're not bringing me food, or there's something wrong here, I'm cold, and you're not bringing me a blanket. That's pretty elemental, that's pretty concrete. But increasingly, as I form representations about who I am in my mind, I draw upon your representations about me, your mirroring of me. I see myself in the mirror of your eyes. What do I see there? And if I see that, you know, if I'm not recognized over here, if I'm not valued over here, if I'm not wanted over here, there must be something wrong with me. If guilt is I did something bad, shame is I am something bad. There's something wrong with me. I'm damaged goods, I'm broken, I'm tainted. If you throw any kind of molestation or other kinds of abuse in the mix, there could be a natural sense that there's something corroded, poisoned, defective, rancid, somewhere deep down, or just, you know, a second-rater. Beat it. Right? So what do we then do as adults? Oh, I was going to say the double whammy. The double whammy is we both experience shame in these interactions that gradually gets woven into the fabric of our brain and the background atmosphere of our mind, which causes us to suffer. But also, too, we tend to act like that whole process didn't really happen. Oh, yeah, junior high didn't affect me. Yeah, right. You know, the first 3-4 years, the fact that your little kid sister or kid brother came along when you were 2 or 3 years old, oh, yeah, that didn't matter. Heck, it did. You went from being crown prince to beggar boy, you know, in the back of the room when that sibling came along whose needs trumped yours. Right? It matters. It counts. It affects us. And we tend to deny it. But actually, that's a second dart of shame, to be ashamed about our own narcissistic longings and the ways that we were injured. Okay. So what do we do now as adults? For one, a lot of this process is internal. We're tracking little things like gaze. Are you looking at me? How long do you sustain attention to me before you bounce out? Or we're tracking other people. They're talking with each other. I come over and stand near you. Do you shift your bodies to include me? Or am I not seen? Right? Or even, do you tighten a little bit in to keep me out? What's that do? Or social comparison. Just look out there. Oh, you've got a nicer car than I have. You have thinner thighs than I do. Right? You've got a cooler mate than I have. You know, your book sold more copies than mine. Not that I'd ever think about that. See what I mean? You know, a lot of it's private, a lot of it's internal. Also, though, we act it out in various ways. And there are two basic patterns. So in a healthy environment, if we grew up, we got a lot of healthy narcissistic supplies. Narcissistic just means mirroring, from the myth of Narcissus, who gazed at his reflection in a pool. Right? If we get a good enough, and good enough depends on the temperament and nature and sensitivities and attunements of the child. But if we got a good enough incoming stream, factually, of healthy narcissistic supplies, healthy amounts of attunement, healthy amounts of rapport, because rapport cannot happen if someone doesn't see you and tune into you, healthy amounts of appreciation, of praise, of complimenting, of understanding, with not too much crud mixed in. If that came at us and we took it in, well, then we have filled up inside, and we carry then with us this sense of being valuable and recognized and beautiful and even special and precious. Right? That's great. On the other hand, if, in my view, you're among the 90% or so, me included, for whom there were some significant issues or problems with that healthy, normal, intended by Mother Nature process of the internalization of experiences of feeling of worth, right? If there were interruptions to that, then people tend to be about that in one of two kinds of ways. They tend to be either overt or covert, right? If they're overt, they'll tend to do little things to pull for those supplies today. And often, the problem is those supplies today are not internalized. So there'll be little actions or tests to see, do I matter to you? Am I special to you? Do you care about me? Do you want me? Saying little things, doing reciprocal narcissistic feeding. Wow, that's such a beautiful blouse. God, hope she likes my shirt. See what I mean? You know, we do these little things like, how much are we gaming it? Right? So that's the overt style. The more covert style, what narcissistic needs? I don't have narcissistic needs. I don't care. We numb ourselves. We shut down the whole process. And I've been realizing lately that one of the major forms in which craving comes is through inertness. We tend to think of craving as active, right? We're reaching for this, we're pushing away that, we're clinging to these, and so forth. And that is the way it manifests a lot. But also a lot, these ways in which I just don't do that. I'm just not that way. I wouldn't want that. I don't go there. That too embodies a kind of craving. Those forms of inertness or boundedness that become the kind of taken for granted bars of our own personal cage. That too is a form of craving, that kind of inertness. So you might want to think about that, how that shows up for you. How we shrink. Shrinkage is a kind of craving. The embodiment of shrinkage today is a manifestation today of a kind of craving. It's quite profound to reflect on. And it's hard to see because it's just our default. It's what we take for granted. It's what we presume. But if we think about our own history and how we acquired, we weren't just born with, but we acquired this way of being, we can see the craving in it. So think about your own stuff with wanting to feel more recognized, valued, and wanted with other people today. And see what it's like to really validate and honor those needs behind the mask, that are operating inside you today. Because they're still real. And they often, they're usually, in my experience, not bizarre or extreme. They're actually perfectly ordinary. And our normal needs for feeling recognized, valued, and wanted today, including the carryover, as well as the carryover from our childhood, when people actually reveal them, and they're usually kind of embarrassed about revealing them, when it's revealed, it just seems so natural almost all the time. You know, part of what I do for a living is talk with messed up people. Most people I talk with aren't very messed up, but every so often I've reminded myself, Rick, if you didn't want to be with people who made your hair stand on end, why did you become a psychotherapist, So in my entire career, I've met only one person, maybe one and a half, that I would consider had a true narcissistic personality disorder. Was truly profoundly caught in narcissism. Most people's, mine included, narcissistic needs that are withheld today or they get enacted through proxies of various kinds, most of them are really legitimate, normal, and it would be healthy for them to be satisfied. So now I want to talk about four suggestions about that, then I'll be quiet and see what you think. First suggestion is to see what the truth is. See the truth of our normal, profoundly human need to be special to other people. To feel like we matter to them, they care about us, they would keep keep coming to get us, to help us. They might get defeated, but not because they quit on us. We want to feel that, you know, you're someone that another person at least would not quit on. All right? We want to feel these things, okay? It's normal to. So seeing the truth of that and seeing the truth of the fine print of your own upbringing, the impact of 10,000 little moments. Right? For example, studies on the preschool toddler age show that roughly 20 times an hour, a typical preschooler or toddler has his or her wants thwarted. That's average every 3 minutes. And that's in an average home. So if you imagine homes that are pretty tuned in and pretty relaxed and pretty supportive, you know, for every one of those, there are homes where that thwarting is much greater than that. So all these little interactions. If you watch relationships in families, especially with young children, there are all these little interactions, these little moments. The gradually accumulating weight, you know, of what happened in those moments, recognized or not, valued or not, wanted or not, right? And how did that actually land inside the person? That really adds up over time. See the truth of that for yourself. Okay? And also see the truth, particularly from a Buddhist perspective, that the events that we want to have happen because they will mean that we are recognized, valued, and wanted, and also the feelings, the experiences we have when others do give us that, all of that is transient. It's passing, right? It is nice. I'm saying that it is appropriate to reach for it and internalize it in skillful and ethical ways, but any of that is a passing phenomenon, and there's wisdom in recognizing that. Okay. Second suggestion, feed the hungry bee. The tendency, isn't it, for most of us, when someone comes at us with a kind of narcissistic longing, you can feel it. They're pulling for that little bit of recognition. They want that praise. Or they're kind of, did you see that thing? Or they wonder, do you see this about me? Do you see my good intentions? Do you see me deep down inside? Right? Or even if they're kind of gross about it and unpleasant, you know, like coming out of the movie industry, right? So, we've talked about me long enough. Let's talk about you. What'd you think of my movie? Right? You know, we feel, even when we're, the tendency, right, is to withdraw, even like smack the hand that reaches out for the praise. Instead, look for opportunities to really cherish other people, to see the beauty in them, to value them, to be brave enough to acknowledge wanting them in certain ways, needing them, being dependent upon them. You know, in other words, know what it's like to give others the kind of recognition and valuing and wanting that we're seeking for ourselves. Practice that. By practicing it, besides it being benevolent, you'll know what it's like. And you'll also see how normal it is. It's not that big a deal to let other people feel like, ba-boom, in this moment, even if I don't know you well, you know, I can feel in a moment that there really is a being in there, a beautiful being in there, and I care about whether you're suffering or not. I may not be able to do anything about it. Our relationship may be strangers on a bus, but in that moment, I'm willing to give to you the sincere wish that you not suffer and instead be truly happy. Right? Okay. So that's the second suggestion. Look for ways to feed the hungry bee, especially if your tendency is to shame the bid for narcissistic supplies from others, probably because your own bids for narcissistic supplies were shamed when you were young or maybe older. Okay. How hard is it to credit people, to appreciate them, to thank them, to let them know that they matter to you? You know. The third suggestion is to steal a line from Brené Brown, dare greatly. Go for it. You know, it's kind of tough-minded, but I'll just say it. You know, take this with a grain of salt. You want to be special? Do special things. You know, empty the dishwasher. Scratch the back. Actually sustain attention you know, past 2 minutes. Go for your own ambitions in life. Start that business. Go on that trip. Write that blog about your trip. Be special. Send that thank you note. Write that poem. Do that movie. Post that video. Write that book. You know, go for it. Why not? And the way to go for it is, I think, to use the line from Leonard Cohen, ring the bells that still can ring, right? Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in, right? In other words, the trick is to go for it without getting hooked up on, will they give back to me? Yeah. The best odds strategy for getting good recognition from others is to be your best self, do the best you can into the world without attachment to the results. That's the best odds strategy. Paradoxically, the best way to treat oneself is to not care about oneself in a certain kind of sense. Okay? So go for it. What in you is your own special gift? Maybe that you was shamed when you were young or people didn't trust in it, or you went for it once and you flopped and it hurt so much you decided never to go for it again. Go for it. Why not? The world needs all of us to go for it in all kinds of ways. And then the last suggestion is, when there is an opportunity to internalize a narcissistic supply, a healthy one of recognition, of valuing, of wanting, bring a big spoon. Really take it in. Even, as appropriate, do the kind of stuff I did when I was younger, especially where someone would say something and I knew what I desperately needed. And I would ask a little more, even. They'd say, well, it was great you were in that meeting, Rick. Really? Thanks. Could you say more about it? And to be brave enough to do that. Now, don't do it Darth Vader, you know, or if you're like my wife and me right now watching the Suits show, you know, don't do that with, what's his name, Lewis? Don't do that with Lewis, right? The villain of the show. But as appropriate, and especially try to feel it, stay with it, and let it take it into that hungry heart while simultaneously letting go of it. So we get the benefit of internalizing the supply without the cost of craving it and getting caught up in craving about it. And gradually, I think what people find, I have totally found this, is that if we accept our own narcissistic longings and prize ourselves, you know, see the sweetness, the innocence, the dearness in ourselves, much as we see it in others and wish that others saw it in us. If we do that, and if we really open our heart to be more receptive, right, to the recognition, the mattering to others, the liking of others, even the cherishing and loving from others, we can really gradually fill that hole in our heart. And then over time, cultivation undoes craving. Because we've internalized this experience, we have filled ourselves up, we're less and less active in terms of looking for or internalizing narcissistic supplies, and it becomes more automatic to take them in when they do come our way. What do you think about that? Any comments or questions? I see hands. I'll try to especially call on people I don't normally call on or haven't. Yeah, please. Inner narcissistic tendencies?
Yeah, you just said that.
Oh, at the very end?
Yeah.
To yourself?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What we do is we internalize other people, and then we start doing to ourselves what they did to us. So if others cherished us and mirrored us and really came to us because they valued us, right? We take that in, and then we tend to do that to ourselves. But if others were dismissive or scorching, then we tend to do that to ourselves as well.
So is that what you meant earlier when you said the inertness, where we shrink or we minimize ourselves? It's the same thing?
Yeah, what I was saying there is that sometimes, and it depends on a child, in terms of attachment theory, the anxious, insecure style from last time I was here would be more overt about pulling for narcissistic supplies, whereas the insecure, avoidant child, the one who typically grew up with dismissing parents in terms of a style, would tend to be more inert about their narcissistic needs. Oh, by inert, I just mean they would be passive about them, or they would not be aware of them, or they would just act like they didn't exist. It's kind of like, it's like you start out, your life is this big, you're a little baby, it could be this big, this whole room, and then as the years go by, you find yourself on you find yourself living on this island. This is my, and it becomes like, duh. What I mean by duh is, this is, of course, I have to live here. This is me. And we become oblivious of the fact that, you know, I used to have all this other space off my island, but I'm just like this. I'm just like this embodies a kind of craving, because it was a learning, it was acquired. And it was acquired in a goal-directed way, based on a desire, a want. I want to feel safe. I don't want to be hurt. I crave safety. I crave getting off your radar. If you see that I want any kind of recognition or praise, you're going to shame me as being a vain sinner on a fast track to hell. I'm not going to reveal any of that. In fact, I'm not even going to have any of that. I'm going to shut that down so deep in my core, it will never see the light of day. Because if anyone ever suspected it when I was growing up, boom, balls of fire in one cultural frame or another, maybe without the religious connotations. See what I mean? Or if I grew up in an environment where narcissistic supplies were in short supply, there wasn't enough to go around. So if you got, you know, maybe a lot of siblings, maybe a big family, a lot of kids, or something else, or a really needy parent, or maybe a parent who is envious or jealous of a child's abilities, right? You know, hey, I better not reveal that I want that. This is a big deal, you know. It really shows up in adulthood in lots of ways, and I'm trying to bring this into the frame of the Buddhist sort of psychology, the Buddhist model. Okay. And so much of what health is, and I think what the great teachers are so much about, it's so interesting, they're about reclaiming the whole estate, you know, opening up to the totality of experiencing, you know, taking the suppress lid off of so much of our own stuff, and feeling the whole of it all, and feeling the whole world, right? And resourcing ourselves enough over time to tolerate feeling everything. Okay. Yeah, it's like awakening is a reclamation project. We're reclaiming ourselves. Other comment or question? Great.
Well, I've noticed that being seen and seeing another, especially a significant other, is much beyond just the visual, of course. Can you, and somehow that's tied into craving?
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, so if we want to be seen, and if we get seen in appropriate ways, and some people care more about being seen than others, just a normal temperamental variation, all right? Okay. But often, just as a detail, the people who look like they don't care much about being seen, they really want to be seen. And they have so much pain around not having been seen in the past that they handle that pain by just kind of numbing the longing, the healthy longing to be seen. Okay. So when we get seen appropriately, that reduces craving, certainly in the moment for that, because that scratch is, that itch is scratched, right? That thirst is slaked. The root of the word for craving is thirst. So if we satisfy it, it helps undo it. If we satisfy it wisely rather than addictively, shoot me up, feed me, see more. Okay? On the other hand, when it's not met, we crave around it. That's what I mean. It's because there's a deficit. We haven't got enough healthy narcissistic supplies. It's like we can live, but there's not enough inside. We naturally want more. And now, in family environments, this quality of, do I matter to you? Do you give a darn? Do you see me as a being in my own right rather than a means to your ends? Really shows up a lot around actions. How do we respond to the wants of others? Do they exist for us? Do we hear them? Do we care about them? Do we covertly or subtly punish or shame other people for having wants because they bother us with their wants, right? Do we do those things? Or can we see their wants? Can we take maximum reasonable personal responsibility? Those are key words, maximum reasonable responsibility for giving them what they want from us and deliver the goods. If we do that, you know, the other person will naturally feel that they matter to us. You know, I think in family life, life altogether, yeah, we want them to do that thing for us that we want. We want the back to be scratched. We want the dishwasher loaded. We want the child picked up on time from school. We want erotic interest to come our way. We want those things, right? That's like a class one want. But what we really want is we want to matter enough to the other person that they would want to give us what we want. That's the class two. That's not getting what we want is a misdemeanor. You know, you didn't scratch my back. You didn't listen carefully when I told you this long story about my sister-in-law. You didn't, you know, come toward me erotically, whatever it was. You know, all right, that's a misdemeanor. But if I don't matter enough to you that you want me to get what I want, that your wants, that my wants are actually in the foreground, on the front burner in your mind, that's a felony, right? That's a serious challenge in a relationship. And it ends relationships when we feel like the other person isn't willing to let our wants really matter to them. And the test of that is often around action, you know, delivering the goods or not. And we're watching them, aren't we? They're watching us. Okay, maybe another person, yeah. Right, right, totally.
How does that fit into what you're saying?
Yeah, so it's great, really. And I'll use this as a way to kind of wrap it up on this point. And I'll come back, and I bet some of our guest teachers will be pursuing this material as well in some ways, perhaps. So first off, my own take on that is to practice what I call unilateral virtue. That's kind of a summary of a lot of material where I establish my own code in my own mind. And much as the Buddha recommended, you know, we are each responsible for our own karmas, the results that just in this life ripple out from our actions or and inactions. So, you know, it's okay. You get to decide for yourself what you're going to do or not do. And then they do what they do. And then we get to decide what we want to do next, right? And if we go to the max and it's always not enough, and then if we try to talk about that and they don't repair with us about it, or even shut down repair, and then if we go to the higher level, the felony level, if you will, class two offense, and we try to repair the lack of repair, and they shut that down, at that point you just take a hard look at the relationship and you say, well, what are my duties to you? Obviously, there's not going to be much reciprocity here, and then I'm going to do what I consider my duty, which might be to wish you well on the other side of the planet. Really? May you not suffer over there. Right? And don't count on me to do everything at the next Thanksgiving, because I see how this game is played. Right? Fool me once, you know, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Kind of. Okay. Part one. Part two, you know, what I think what's so interesting is the power of seeing beneath the surface in the other person and kind of leaning into that and tending to that in a caring kind of way. That's appropriate. That's appropriate boundaries. But just think about what happens when you're with someone. It's sad. It's so uncommon, isn't it? But when you're with someone, and you can tell that they're seeing in you beneath the surface or behind the first veil or two. And based on what they're seeing, and it could be imperfect or not, and they're trying to see, they speak to it and they value what's there. They're sensitive to what's there. They care about what's there. Right? They may be preserving their boundary. They may not want to hire you for the job, but they could see the longing in you for that kind of job and the fact that you really are a strong candidate. And out of 100, honestly, there was someone who was just unbelievable, and we're going to hire that person. But you can feel. They saw something, or maybe they don't want to date you anymore, but they still see something in you. Or you're a child, and you're getting sorted out in some quarrel with a sibling, but that parent still sees your good intentions. You know what I mean? You really wanted something good to happen there, even though the wheels came off and you and your sibling made each other mad. Okay, right? Isn't that powerful? It's so powerful. When people just give us that, they see our intelligence. They see our sweetness, right? They see our kindness. They see those things in us. Or they see our longings to manifest, you know, to be included. And they don't shame us for them. They actually cherish us about them. That is a huge impact. Turn it around. Very often, when people come at us with these various proxy desires, the truth is, there's just a cover-up for the deeper one that they're embarrassed about or ashamed about or trying to hide because they don't know whether we're really going to deliver the goods to the deeper one. And if we can see the deeper feelings and recognize them and not shame the person for having them, even if they have anger toward us, like the understandableness of that, when we give that to other people, even if we don't deliver anything behaviorally or materially, just that seeing, which can often, it only takes 5, 10, 20 seconds. Sometimes we spend more time with it. Doesn't necessarily take that long. You know, isn't it true? Other people just kind of cool down. And it's so interesting to look inside. You know, I look inside at what makes us so stingy about this. Doesn't cost much, if anything at all, to see what's special and beautiful, to see the longings in the other person, to see the pain, to see the longings that come from pain. Doesn't cost us much to do that, and yet we tend to be kind of miserly about it, rather than realizing, even in a self-interested way, that by releasing it and giving it, it's our best odd strategy for getting good treatment from others, and it's a beautiful practice in its own right. Including a practice, really, of releasing selfing, which is a place to sum up here, the paradox, actually, that internalizing supplies about ourselves and cherishing what's special in other selves is a profound way to undo the self-contraction, the sense of me, myself, and I. And that's really the whole point. So how about we sit with this for a minute and then go out and find some people to cherish?
Can we take a moment to wish you well?
What?
Jan, are you coming there?
Sure.
This is
unplanned.
Oh, good. What's up?
Well, I just want to extend on behalf of the group.
Yeah?
Our best wishes for you. May you travel well.
Oh, thank you.
May those who receive you see you and Jan.
Oh, good. This is my sweet wife.
And your sweet wife. And may those that hear your message be enriched by it.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to miss you.
Oh, sweet. Love you. Thank you, man. That's great. And when people, you know, deliver it, bring the spoon. That's really sweet. I have a pretty big spoon at this point. All right. Let's sit for a minute. well. Take care. Bring a big spoon. See you in a couple months.